All right, we're ready to hear from you on QBE Specialty Insurance Company versus Scrap.
Good morning. May it please the court. My name is Robert Beasley on behalf of the appellant, Scrap, Inc. An insured, like any other party to a contract, is entitled to an adjudication of its rights under that contract. And that adjudication, in most cases under a contract dispute, like this case, involve questions of fact that must be resolved by the trier of fact. Instead, what occurred in this case, the district court was presented by counter-opposing motions for summary judgment, the Scrap one being supported by affidavits, and instead of once finding issues of fact on two issues, one being the coverage issue and the issue of fact as to pollution exclusion, made express findings of those being issues of fact, instead of then concluded as should be done under the rules of summary judgment that the matter should proceed to trial, then skipped forward into this allocation issue, what I've labeled as the allocation trap in my briefing, to determine that the Scrap company did not allocate at the trial level on these certain issues and therefore loses the case. There has never been an adjudication of the coverage or exclusions issues presented in this case. What actually occurred is the QB issued a reservation of rights letter saying some of these are not covered, and then did not file a declaratory action on the matter, but rather waited to the conclusion of the underlying case to file its deck action. And then the trial court at the deck action case on summary judgment determined issue of fact on claim of sickness, which is a coverage issue, issue of fact on the pollution exclusion, which is an exclusion issue. Interesting on that, QBE bears the burden on that issue to prove. And then the
issue you say QBE waited. I mean, I think your colleague is going to stand up and say, we didn't wait at all. We were waving every flag. We were trying to give we did everything we could to try to get the damages allocated so that we would know what we covered. And our insured refused to do it.
When I say waited, I mean as to filing a declaratory action to get a judicial action. What you're describing is this position on the transferring of the shifting of the burden on allocation that QBE will tell this court and has told the lower court that they did everything they could.
Well, they did. I mean, they sent five letters. They tried to intervene twice. I mean, what more could or should they have done?
We do have issue with the letters issue. QBE's position is that all they have to do is send a letter that has some vague and ambiguous, some of these might not be covered, issue. The Duke v. Hawk case says you have to do much more than that.
But they did much more than that.
Somewhat. At least the pretense of doing much more. The two intervention motions were in contradictory of Florida civil procedure. They were never going to be successful. They could not be successful. The intervention statute prohibits insurance companies from coming in on the basis that they attempted to. So those were false gestures.
But didn't they also at that time present proposed?
Yes.
I mean, and so if they did, then why didn't you all adopt them after they had told you that you needed to do that and cited the case law that showed that you needed to do that?
Here's the essence of that issue. The shifting of the burden, and we can debate whether the burden did or didn't shift, not really relevant for these purposes, because the trap's beyond that. All of the cases on allocation, once it shifts, which is the question, relate to the same operative facts in which there are alternative legal theories. Every case you see, there's two alternative legal theories: intentional torts, negligence, product liability, or negligence. The jury has the same operative facts, and they're being charged by the law with different theories. Allocation would be appropriate in that case. In the cases, there's only three, the cases that are cited that show that the insured had the burden to allocate, and if they don't, they lose, all operate under the same facts. What happened here is different. QBE and their coverage letter and their 40 special interrogatories created new facts. So basically what we're suggesting here is that the burden on the insured was to take this coverage letter of the insurance company, then throughout the course of the underlying case, develop new and different facts, not related to the tort claim or the nuisance claim, but related to the coverage issue. They have to hire their own counsel to do it. They have to hire their own experts to do it. They have to develop that entire line of additional facts, not related to the case. Then they have to convince the trial judge to let those operative, irrelevant facts into the underlying case. which is hard to do because trial judges are charged not to allow that to happen. Then they have to convince the trial judge to have 40 special verdict forms. 40.
Well, that's saying if you did exactly what they suggest in those letters. As a practical matter, though, it seems to me that unless you believe that no allocation was ever going to be necessary, you could have developed your own theories, you could have negotiated with them, you could have done something that would then put us in a position to say, had you done what you should, had they done what they should. I take it there was no legal reason that you could not, that you, as the counsel for Scrap, could not have submitted some suggested instructions or interrogatories.
Well, there was a legal reason. First of all, the 40 special verdict forms did get submitted, and the trial court said the parties had not garnered or presented evidence for which the jury could answer those questions. And that's the latent poison pill in the whole scenario.
But in what sense, counsel, as part of their motion to intervene?
No, at the jury charge conference, at the verdict charge conference, those special interrogatory forms were submitted, attempted to be submitted, and the trial court rejected them.
By you or by QBE counsel?
By QBE's counsel. And the trial court rejected them by saying this, and this is very important because it reveals the problem. The parties have not developed or presented their evidence in a way that these questions could be answered. So what that means is that this defect, when they create issues of fact, not alternative theories of law that have to be allocated, this defect exists from the beginning of the case because these are facts that have to be decided, not legal theories. And so what happens is the insurer becomes burdened with, you know, the Reynolds case calls it an impossible burden, but it's a contemplated impossible burden. Because from the start of the case, the insured would have to prepare evidence, to include experts, by the way. They'd have to hire their own experts so that these 40 questions could even be answered. And that's the key to the whole thing. It's not about the special verdict form. That's at the end. That's why it applies to those cases in which there are alternative legal theories. But it cannot apply to a case like this when the issues are not relevant to the underlying action. They require additional facts and expert testimony. And so what we have is a trap. It's not as though these 40 special verdict forms, let's say the trial court allowed them in. The trial court would never allow them in because there's no evidence to support it, right? The jury would be left with 40 questions they couldn't answer. But let's say they answered it, allowed them in, and we did our job. We've now satisfied our burden. The jury could not answer them. There's not sufficient evidence in the case to answer them. I gave you a sample of one in my reply brief to show you that there's no facts in which the jury could fill it out. So it's complete trap from the beginning. Because this case went on 5 years, which means during that 5 years, the insured had to have anticipated those 40 forms. Their counsel, assigned by their insurance company, won't participate at all in this part of the case, right? Because it relates to coverage, so they're conflict. So what do they have to do? They have to hire their own lawyer from the start. They have to develop their own body of evidence. They got to answer those 40 questions if the judge lets it in. Then they have to hire experts, because the one question I showed you is one of 40 that requires expert testimony. Then they have to convince the court to get that stuff into the trial, the underlying trial, to answer the 40 questions. It's not about the special verdict form. That is a good example of what applies in the four cases you have on allocation when it's alternative legal theories, same facts. This is a harsh result on the insured, and it has to be limited in some way. And the way it has to be limited is, if the insured, once the burden shifts, and we can ignore this issue of the notices and all that for a minute, but once the burden shifts, if the insured can get an allocation accomplished within the existing body of evidence, then it's the insured's duty and burden, without a doubt. But if the insured on this shifting burden is faced with a letter, that's all QBE had to do was send out a letter, according to them, and it says, we think you're not covered on these things. Therefore, for the next 5 years, we need you to generate facts and expert testimony so you can answer our questions for us. And guess what? The prevailing case law says that if those questions aren't answered to QBE's satisfaction, they can then disregard the entire decision, file their own new deck action because they weren't a party to the underlying suit. It is a no-win for the insured if you allow this allocation trap to be extended to this degree. And that's what happened.
From your point of view, then, is there anything QBE could have or should have done to get this allocation issue in play, or simply that because of the differing facts as you've raised them, they had to wait. It's just the nature of the case.
There is one thing they could have done. The Wausau Court, which is on page 31 of my brief, comes up with a methodology, and other courts have adopted it. It said, wait till the jury returns its verdict. Then ask to intervene then. Now all of a sudden you're compliant with Florida law, because Florida law says you can't intervene during the pendency of the case. Once the verdict's returned, you can intervene. Now they're having a compliant intervention motion. And then send the jury back for 30 minutes and ask them to fill out these inquiries. They've already created the number, 750,000. Now go back and allocate. That's what the Wausau court said you could have done and that they should have done, but they didn't do it that way. Now, here's—
But according to you, they wouldn't have been able to do it.
Right, right. But the question was, is there any way that this can be done? Setting aside for a minute the issue that you have to have additional facts. Some of the 40 probably could have been answered within the existing body of evidence, but the key 40.
Could you have asked that? That is, you seemed, I was a little startled, but I'll ride with it, that after the jury provides that, then you could have asked them to go back and allocate. You could have asked for that at that point.
We could have asked for that, but not with the 40 that they presented because of the other problem. I was trying to answer one of your questions.
Okay.
Is there a way to do it? There is a way to
okay,
do it.
But given that they had now said, okay, you owe this much, you could have asked them some questions relating to how they got to this amount.
Right.
But
we could not have asked
them. I take it there's some time questions here that,
right.
Because I know there's a fight about 1 year, but clearly some of the events have happened after any coverage. Is that right?
That's correct.
So let's pass the fight about the 1 year.
And the fight about the 1 year is
those are the kind of questions that could have been asked.
There could have been some of the questions asked, but they would not have resolved the two issues that are in the deck action. The coverage question relates to dividing out the types of pain and suffering versus mental anguish versus sickness versus such. Could not have been asked because there's no testimony to support that. The pollution exclusion divides out different environmental factors in which no one had the interest or ability to divide out at the underlying case. Again, this is a separate case, but it was but we were burdened by the allowable evidence in the underlying case. So it could be done to some extent, and it certainly should be done when it's alternative legal theories. But in this case, allowing them to create facts that then we must charge the jury with by presenting the evidence that we haven't developed is impossible.
Thank you, Mr. Beasley. You've reserved 3 minutes of your time for rebuttal.
May it please the court. I'm Rebecca Applebaum, counsel for QBE in this case. First, it's not a non-intervention statute. It's a non-joinder statute. Intervention is permissible under certain circumstances. QBE sought permissive intervention after it became clear that the insured was not going to accept its suggestion, its notice that they needed to seek allocation of the verdict under Duke.
He makes a lot of the fact that the questions that you wanted the jury to answer were so numerous, that there were 40 of them. Was there ever any attempt that you're aware of to kind of negotiate what that verdict form would look like and make it simpler?
There was an attempt to pare those down.
I'm talking about a mutual effort.
No, communication wasn't flowing well on that issue during the course of the underlying trial.
Would it have been helpful to you to break it down between, bodily injury and property injury, for example?
Yes, and actually those were in there. What occurred was that the suit against Scrap, when it was brought, included numerous theories of potential recovery, some that were clearly outside of the coverage of the policy, and the initial set of 40 questions went to all of them. And further communication to the insured suggested some might not be necessary based on the way the case proceeded to trial, only on the two issues of negligence and nuisance. And I have to disagree with Mr. Beasley. First, that QBE was demanding that all 40 questions be asked, and second, that there was no way, even with what they had, to accomplish this. And it was clear from the correspondence that obviously
accomplish, when you said this, accomplish what?
Accomplish obtaining an allocated verdict.
Okay.
For example, one of the questions on the verdict form to nuisance was a general question that said nuisance is comprised of inconvenience, annoyance, discomfort, or loss of enjoyment of property. In one question, would have been very easy to break those out and have a line for if you found nuisance damages, were they for discomfort, question mark? Were they for annoyance, question mark?
Okay, let me ask you this. Certainly appears that the opposing group did not do anything along the lines of what you had suggested. But if they had done everything and the court had simply rejected it, are they still in the same position? Do they still lose because the trial judge won't allow any allocation? Or does that satisfy their burden and shift it back to you for a subsequent action?
That's an excellent question. And actually, not a single case since this court's predecessor instituted Duke has addressed that question. But I think Judge Rogers in C.D. Jones took a look at that and gave the gave an alternative in those circumstances. The requirement in Duke is that the carrier, because it could benefit from an unallocated verdict when it's defending under a reservation of rights, needs to notify its insured of the right to seek allocation in order to meet the burden.
Because otherwise, then they would claim in the subsequent actions that there's no allocation, therefore they win.
Exactly. And so your predecessor in Duke said it's incumbent in defending under a reservation of rights to make sure the insured is aware that they have the right to do this to help them satisfy their burden later. And so in this case, QBE did that. But they go on, and I think this is where if they do everything they're supposed to, and the trial judge prevents that, they go on to say that at that point, they don't say that at all, actually. They just say if the insured doesn't do what it's supposed to. The alternative is that the district judge can look at the record and make that attempt to allocate if the carrier at that point shows that some portion of the unallocated verdict is for not covered damages. And I actually think Judge Rogers in this case took that next step anyway. Even though she made explicit findings that QBE complied with its obligation by notifying them that they had the right to seek allocation to help them satisfy their burden as the party seeking to recover under the policy to show coverage, which is why summary judgment was appropriate, actually, because they couldn't do that. She didn't find questions of fact with respect to that. She found questions of fact with respect to whether there was anything covered in the underlying unallocated judgment. Which are two different things. So what they can do at that point, what the district judge can do at that point is look at the record and see if based on the record they can allocate based on the testimony and the underlying action. And she tried to do that here. She looked at the portions of the transcript that were presented. She looked at the pleadings, the policies, and the portions of the transcript and the affidavits that were submitted, and found that still they were insufficient to form a quantity of evidence fit to form a reasonable basis for the judgment. And if the court can't do it, so the court
in this case she found no basis. But as a matter of general law, there might be some other case where everything else happened the same, and then in the deck action, judge looks at it and says, fine, I'll allocate or I'll say no coverage.
Correct. And that's exactly what happened in Arnett.
Or 100% coverage.
Right. That's exactly what happened in Arnett. And I have to correct something Mr. Beasley said, which is that this issue has only come up where it's an all or nothing, negligence versus intentional sort of proposition. And that's not the case either. Arnett was a case of construction defect where the defective work wouldn't have been covered, but the resulting property damage would have. C.D. Jones is very similar. It's another case with a construction manager and a similar issue. And so here in Scrapp's affirmative motion for summary judgment, they said no discovery was necessary and the trial court was capable of allocating based on the policy, the pleadings, and the transcripts, and then submitted evidence to the district judge. And Judge Rogers looked at that and found that insufficient. And because there was no way for her to allocate at that point, she thought summary judgment in favor of QBE was appropriate, I think correctly, because again, we don't even actually need to get there because the burden never shifted from the party seeking to recover under the policy in this case. They certainly could have submitted the questions that QBE gave them. They could have submitted their own questions to allocate. As you pointed out, they could have asked the jury afterward. I have not seen a single case, despite what Mr. Beasley said, where that has occurred, and the Lavender Court suggested it because there the parties tried to intervene prior to the jury getting the case.
I'm sorry, the what kind of court?
It was Lavender.
Lavender.
It was Employers Insurance Company of Wausau versus Lavender, where the court suggested that in the interest of judicial economy, the parties agreed that maybe they could ask the jury in the trial court afterward. But that's not actually what occurred in that case, and I have not seen that occur since. So, it's QBE's position that the burden never shifted to start with, and it always remains with the party seeking coverage, seeking to recover under the policy to show that something is covered and to show the amount of what's covered because the burden didn't shift. We don't actually need to reach Duke. The Second Circuit just recently said the same thing that distinguished Duke in the situation where the insured had full notice of the allocation issue, had the opportunity to allocate, and chose not to exercise that right. So the Second Circuit in Uvino versus Harleysville in 2017 found you don't even reach the question of whether burden shifting is necessary. And the same thing happened here, so the burden never shifted to QBE. But even as you pointed out, if some situation beyond the insured's control after it was notified prevented that, the district judge, or the trial court judge, for example, Judge Rogers in C.D. Jones refers back to Duke, where it allows the district judge to look at the evidence. They say the trial transcript is the best evidence. I think it is. As you pointed out, there could be a situation where the evidence would be sufficient. Here, for example, if the trial transcript reflected there's some testimony that a power line fell down. If the trial transcript reflected testimony that the power line fell down, landed on the homeowner's car, and the cost of repair was $2,500, that would have been something in the record to indicate the potential for covered damages in the jury verdict. But we didn't have anything like that here. Certainly nothing that was submitted to Judge Rogers as she went through it and found nothing. It's our position that summary judgment was appropriate. There was no material issue of fact with respect to this issue. Whether there was a question of whether the exclusions apply or whether the testimony constitutes covered or non-covered damages, we absolutely didn't have a chance to reach that issue because we don't know what the jury was thinking with the unallocated verdict, and there's no way to find out. And the trial judge did everything she could to see if there was something, a quantity of evidence fit to form a reasonable basis for the judgment, and she found none. So it's QBE's position that summary judgment was appropriate. Similarly, Scrap appealed a second order denying its counterclaim for bad faith as moot. Under Florida law, there has to be coverage before there can be bad faith in the first instance. So we believe that ruling was correct, but Judge Rogers also gave them the opportunity to brief that, and they didn't, so she found that they abandoned that issue. And so it would be our position that both orders should be upheld. Thank you.
Thank you.
So the district court judge on a summary judgment standard, given the issues of fact that were not presented in the underlying case, cannot look at the underlying case record in this matter and find the relevant facts to support the position in the deck action. That's because they weren't there. That's the whole point, is that the trial did not include those facts. They weren't relevant to the underlying case. Scrap should have been permitted, once the court found issues of fact, to present its facts to support both the claims and the allocation at its deck action trial, but it didn't get that opportunity. Somehow, the trial court, by the way, did reject the 40 special interrogatory forms and said something very informative, which I think controls this entire analysis, which is At that point, the evidence wasn't in the record for the jury to even decide those questions. And that's the key point of this, what I'm calling the allocation trap. It's not the same operative facts with different legal theories applied, in which at the end of the trial, when it's all said and done, the party can submit a jury verdict form to sort this out. It's that on these issues, a whole entire new set of facts not relevant to the underlying case had to be produced. The trial court recognized that and said, I can't use your 40, not because I don't want to, but because, of course, the plaintiffs objected, but because the jury couldn't answer the questions anyway. This burden, the shifting of the burden to the insured, makes sense when it's alternative legal theories. It makes no sense at all, and it's impossible. It actually is impossible to run a parallel trial inside of the underlying case to allow these sufficient facts. So they weren't there for the jury verdict forms to work. They weren't there for the district court to peer down into the transcript and be able to resolve the question on summary judgment.
Let's say that we agree with you, just for the sake of this question, that the Duke scenario is limited to when there are common questions. Okay. I mean, you previously indicated that there were some questions that were common that could have probably been answered that were submitted. So why would you not then, under your burden to show that you're covered, have had the responsibility to submit at least those to the jury? And then when you stood before us, you could say, we couldn't have submitted the other ones. We did what we could, but now the burden is back on QBE. Why is that not the answer here?
I'm sorry, and I think the part I've missed to tell you is that there was a typical verdict charge instruction charge conference, and the defendants did submit a much more elaborate set. The trial judge went with the plaintiff set anyway, and so you had a set from the defendants, which included a much greater breakdown. Then you had the plaintiff set, which was much more simple. The trial judge elected this plaintiff set. At the same time, you had QBE saying, we want you to do these 40 special, and the trial judge rejected that by saying, we couldn't answer those questions anyway because the evidence wasn't there to support it.
But even in your more specialized submission, would they have allocated the decision to the jury as far as the allocation?
The ones that could be answered with the facts admitted into that case. The ones that couldn't be answered, no, because they couldn't be answered. That's the whole point.
Right, but what I'm asking you is, were your jury instructions, did you have special interrogatories that you submitted that were rejected on any of these allocation questions? Because that's what you just have suggested to me, as I understood it, but I may have misunderstood.
Some of the questions, not all of the 40 is the answer. Some of the allocation questions would have been handled by the defendant's submittal.
I think I'm
had
not
been
being,
accepted.
Right. I'm not maybe not being clear. You said a moment ago that you submitted instructions, but that the judge decided to go with the plaintiff's instructions.
Correct.
Okay. You said your instructions or your proposed instructions were much more detailed, and my question to you is, was there also some kind of special interrogatory form that you had also submitted that was rejected that would have answered any of these allocation questions?
Some of them, but not the ones that required facts not in evidence. Yes. Had ours been accepted,
and where is
that in
the record?
It's in our jury instructions, which are part of the submitted record, which is supporting the summary judgment. So some of these, we would be in a situation like Judge Boggs suggested, which is some were allowed and some weren't, and should we be penalized by those that weren't? But So yes, some were submitted. None of ours were accepted, by the way. The plaintiffs were accepted wholeheartedly.
So just to be clear, you submitted special verdict requests that would have required allocation by the jury on at least some of the issues.
Some of the issues, but not the entire 40, and not the ones that had factual basis that were not in the body of evidence. Thank you.
Thank you. So now I'll call the case of Olivia.